has to do with looking ahead at the 80s and going out with good courage. I think most of us, as we look back at the 70s, feel some little feeling of relief that it wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be. At the end of the 60s, I remember, the president of the seminary where I was teaching, and at his retirement dinner, he stood up and repeated from memory a long poem which had as its punchline over and over again, "Keep her bow against the shore." And it had to do with a shipwreck where the captain was telling the young pilot that the only way the ship was going to survive this tremendous storm was to keep her bow against the shore. As the incoming president of that seminary, I had a feeling of seasickness for that presentation, because all the indicators were at the end of the 60s that the 70s were going to be even worse. And here we are at the 80s, and we got through pretty well. But now we look at the 80s, and perhaps with more reason, there is a sense of crisis that kind of hovers around the corners of a lot of our thoughts. And we wonder just what it's going to be like ahead, particularly for the church, I suppose, also for our society. But since we're gathered here as persons related to the church and committed to it, there's a lot of concern. And that concern seems to grow principally out of the feeling that the changes that we are going through are beginning to pile up, and they are getting to be a little rapid. I read in a newspaper not too long ago, a letter written in, "Haven't we suffered enough from innovation already not to start up something new so soon? Many of us remember what the new hymnal did for us, and we hear complaints now about our newer service. So don't let's go too fast." I had a friend who ran for office in Virginia, and his campaign slogan was, "Stop the trend." He never defined what the trend was. He never said how he was intending to stop it, but he won the election. And there's a great comfort in that hope that somehow somebody is going to, quote, stop the trend. Now, as we look at the church, and I'm thinking here of Christianity generally, but in this group, pretty much the Lutheran Church, because as Herb Kjellstrom took his census the first session, it looked as though we had an overwhelming number of Lutherans, and I imagine that the same would be true for this session, because people who may not be Lutheran still might like to come and hear about the Holy Spirit. But losing teddy bears is something that only Lutherans would be interested in. I wouldn't be interested in going at it this way. How many of you here come from families where both parents were Lutheran? Okay, keep your hands up. Okay, now if we add one parent Lutheran, okay, just keep your hands up because I want to see them. Okay, now you can drop that now. No parents Lutheran. Okay, how many of those of you, this is a hand-stretching period, a little calisthenics. Okay, I'll keep mine up too, just to show as possible. Okay, no parents Lutheran. Now, if you married a Lutheran, you can drop your hand. Okay, so the rest of you are Lutheran by choice, huh?
Don't be afraid. Just keep it.
Okay, that helps us see a little bit about our composition here. The overwhelming number of us are at least second generation Lutherans. I'm married to a Norwegian, a native Norwegian. And so we were standing in line for ice cream the other day, and this young man right in front of me turned around and said, "I'm Norwegian too." I said, "Oh, were you born in Norway?" "No." "Was your father born in Norway?" "No." "Who was?" "Well, I don't know." And his mother said, "Your father's great grandfather." So that's identification way back, and I suspect probably Lutheran all the way. So I want to address Lutherans then, who are probably pretty well committed to their tradition, their church, and who are therefore maybe a bit uneasy about what's going to happen, because the next question I'm going to ask is, okay, how many of you have children over 18? Have children over 18? I'm going to have a hand stretch again, okay? How many of you now with children over 18 have all those children in the Lutheran Church? Okay. Thank you, that's all you can answer. About two-thirds of those who have children are saying that their children are not in the Lutheran Church. Although when we talked about grandparents, everybody, many of you said both parents at least were. That tells us something about a shift that's taking place, and I want to discuss that a bit. I want to discuss basically with you the feeling that many people have that within the next 10 years or so, the church is in for lots of bumps and lots of problems. In order to put that in perspective, I want to go back and say that Lutherans are used to that. If you think things are tough now, so to speak, just think of some of the crises that were faced by Lutherans who came to this country in earlier generations. I want to start with the first great crisis that struck them, and that was to move from a system in which there was an established church to a country in which there was no establishment. Now, first a word about the established church. By that I mean, what would it be like if in your congregation the pastor's salary, money for church colleges and seminaries, upkeep of your building, and utilities for staff and building all were cared for by the government? What would you be able to do then with all the money that you would have? That is, think of the offering you get and how much of current offerings go for the upkeep of these activities. Now, in an established church, that means the state supports through taxation the church, and many of those aspects, at least back at the time we're talking about, all of those aspects were covered by state contributions. In fact, one English wag paraphrased what we sing every morning here, the doxology, and this way: "Praise tax from which all blessings flow. Praise tax all creatures here below. Praise tax above ye heavenly host, for while it flows, the church may coast." There is a certain sense of truth in that, that there are vast burdens financially removed from the church by an establishment. Now, many of the first Lutherans who came to this country, whether from Scandinavia or from Germany, came out of an established church tradition, and many of the clergy who came were really shocked to discover that many of the supports that they had, which made a Lutheran church and made it possible to carry on the work of the church and the pastor, were simply not here. For example, one of those was discipline. How did you know who the true pastors were, whether you were a member of a congregation or another minister? People were coming over all the time. They were getting off the boat, and they would travel to the Midwest or to the frontier, and they would come into a little group of settlers, and they would say, "I'm a Lutheran minister." And people would say, "Well, show us your ordination papers." And they'd say, "Well, while we were at sea, this great wave came across the boat and swept all of my belongings overboard. So I don't have anything with me but the shirt on my back, but trust me." And if they had children to baptize and people to bury and marriages to be performed, they would trust these traveling preachers, quote, for a while, until the travelers proved to be rascals and not at all interested in the welfare of the congregation. And after getting a few fees for the baptisms and the marriages they performed, they would probably skip town. And the congregation would be bereft of pastoral care. Well, many of the regularly ordained clergy and many of the lay leaders of the time said, this is intolerable. We've got to have some system whereby we can authenticate and find out, as we did in the old country, who the true shepherds might be. So it's interesting to me that one of the pioneer Lutheran leaders of this country, Henry Muhlenberg, in the 1700s, went to the governor of the state of Pennsylvania and asked for help. Because used to the state church system, he figured you'd go to the governor, go to the authorities. He wrote Governor Robert Morris and said, there are many, but we shall never get rid of these vagabond preachers until our gracious superiors, that's the state authorities, are pleased to demand proper credentials of all who exercise the ministry and no longer suffer vagabonds to laugh at us who are regular clergymen by saying, quote, it's a free country. You want to know where that quotation originated, at least that early. Now, the other problem that they faced when they left behind an established church was the regular support which the state provided to not only the clergy, but to congregations in terms of church buildings and church maintenance. Did you know in this country, the way it was done in those early years was that a subscription would be taken up for the minister? That is, at the beginning of the year, somebody, a deacon or someone, would go around and get people to sign up. So many bushels of wheat, a side of beef, or corn, or whatever it might be. And they would make this contribution, sometimes in cash, pledged to do that for the upkeep of the clergy and his horse. Well, of course, not everybody paid. And some people didn't pay at all. One of these early pioneer ministers said, in fact, there seemed to be a direct relation to the preaching and the income. He said, if we come too close to their consciences, they let loose and cry, what right does this parson have to order me about? Of course, I pay him by the year. If he does not preach according to my liking, I'll go to another church and get my preaching for nothing. Probably be worth that, too. Yeah. This idea of being able to move. If you don't like the preaching in one place, you go somewhere else and pay your money there and take your choice. And if your choice changes, you can go pay somebody, some other preacher. And if you don't want to pay anybody, you just move every year. Okay, this was a fact which was unexpected for life in the New World. And Lutheran clergy had to get used to that. One of the first ways they coped with it was to form synods or districts of some sort whereby they could essentially check out new clergy coming in to see that they were adequately prepared and could prevent some of this church skipping by enforcing congregations to support clergy whom they had regularly called to do that. Well, what happened was, you see, that they did survive. That instead of the church falling apart without having all this state support, they survived very well. In fact, if you look back now, you discover that the churches which relied on state support in America before the Revolution, basically the Episcopal Church and the Congregational Church, faded rapidly and were out-preached, out-populated, outrun by the churches which had learned from the beginning to be adept at the voluntary system which developed in America. And so, while if you took a census in 1774 of what church is most likely to succeed in the U.S., you probably would have picked the Congregationalists. They were the established church in New England, and they were favorable to the revolutionary cause, and they looked like they were going to expand wildly as the country went west.
but they faded right after the Revolution. Although they remained established till 1828 in Massachusetts, it did do a bit of good. And the frontier went to the Methodists and the Baptists, generally, who were adapted to going out there, dealing with people, and developing a church on a voluntary basis. And Lutherans? Well, Lutherans made the transition pretty well. Many Lutherans, as you know, came over because they disliked the church system in Europe, and they wanted a freer, more voluntary system. In fact, some Lutheran bodies, particularly the Norwegian tradition, got started in this country as a reaction against the state church. So, lesson number one, or crisis number one, says it's possible to exist without some of those props, some of those security blankets that we thought we needed. And in fact, in this country, you did a lot better once you left them behind. It seemed at first as though it would be easier to have the state support the church. But in the long run, it worked out better to develop a voluntary system because it meant the people had a greater commitment in the organization, the leadership, and the growth of the congregation. That was crisis number one. Scarcely was that over. In fact, in some places it was still going on when crisis number two hit. This is the crisis of language. That is, the immigrants came over with the language of the old country. And when they came, they brought their hymn books, they brought their Bibles with them, and they set up not only churches, but almost invariably schools, so that the next generation would also be able to read and pray and sing in the right language. I'm sure you've all heard the story which I learned from my wife about the Norwegian congregation in the Midwest that was debating the use of English. They asked, the younger group asked the older group, well, you mean to say that God doesn't understand English? And the answer was, yeah, he understands it, but he doesn't like it very well. Okay, so there was a general hope to hold on. And it wasn't just for the sake of the past. It was, in fact, as Herb Chilstrom pointed out the first hour, there are many concepts in one language that simply do not translate easily. The word Geist, for example, in German, has a richness and a strength about it, which you translate a spirit in English, and you get a kind of ghostly, filmy, immaterial quality about it that you lose. And there were many other words like that, that when they came over to the new language seemed impoverished. Coupled with that, the fact that the experience of the immigrants was that when the children learned the new language, they tended to lose the old religion. A missionary along the frontier said, people put away their Lutheran heritage with their, in this case, German language. In other words, when they leave the language corral, the linguistic group, they tend also to adopt now English language religions. The Danes were particularly adept at that. The Danes acculturated very rapidly. One out of five Danes who came to this country stayed in the Lutheran Church, left the Lutheran Church, excuse me. One out of five, about 20% in the first generation. The Swedes acculturated a bit more slowly and were also more numerous. About one out of 10 in the first and second generations left. The Norwegians kept together better, kept the language going longer, and lost only about 1 out of 15. So the linguistic cradle proved to be a very, very strong way of holding the faith together. It's no wonder that, for example, a German magazine as early as 1813 said that it was really dangerous to lose the language of the parents. I quote this magazine. A German who becomes an Englishman, a worthy man once told me, to become an Englishman obviously means to speak now the new language. A German who becomes an Englishman is like a silkworm who works himself out of his fine, safe home, becomes a butterfly, flutters around, and perishes. Moral, stay in the cocoon. Or as Warren would say, German. As a result of these concerns over preserving the language, there was, of course, a vast effort to promote schools and education so the young people can learn the language. And in the case of, I'm using the Germans because it's sometimes easier to look at others than to look at one's own tradition too closely. The Germans developed a liturgy fairly early in this country, and they rewrote it right after the Revolutionary War. And one of the petitions in the general prayer was for the German language. Let me read it to you. Inasmuch as it has pleased thee, chiefly by means of the Germans, to transform this state into a blooming garden, which is the language we're talking about, and this desert into pleasant pasturage, help us not to deny our nationality, but to endeavor that our dear youth may be so educated that German churches and schools may not only be preserved, but may attain a still more flourishing condition. Well, that was one prayer that wasn't answered. But notice the concern. The concern was for the dear youth. Concern was that the faith might be translated intact to the next generation. They were already worried about the fact that German churches and schools would not be preserved. So they prayed to God that he would, now in his power, keep the dear youth within the linguistic fold. But, of course, the dear youth were learning English in school and elsewhere, and it soon became evident that you were going to have to learn a new language. One of the early pioneers put it very well. We should look at language, he said, as we look at a bridge over a river. Whether it's made of oak, German, or of birch bark, English, is not important, so long as it holds and enables us to get across and toward our goal. That could be called the instrumentalist use of language, and the fact that it was important. Many people said to make that transition, to take the gamble, to go out with good courage and start learning English, and that would not necessarily lead to the end of the Lutheran Church. In fact, it was probably the only way the church could survive. There is a story about a New York mouse. The mouse had come in from the Midwest. I learned an interesting turn of phrase, by the way. I grew up in Southern California, and whenever we went to Minnesota, it was always called going back east.
That's right.
But when Minnesotans go east to New Jersey, they talk about going out east. So it indicates where the center of the world really is. Well, this mouse went out east to New York and found that the cats in New York were just as ferocious as the cats in Minneapolis. And this mouse was chased down the street and slipped into a crack in the pavement and crouched there panting and waiting. He knew that cat was lurking right beside that crack, waiting for him to come out. But soon he heard a dog bark very close by, and he reasoned, where there's a dog, the cat will flee. So he scurried out of his hiding place, only to be pounced upon by the cat who was sitting right there. "Ah, my little friend," the cat said, "I have learned that in order to survive in this city, one must become bilingual." That was a lesson we learned once, and we're now learning again, that not only now must we be Swedish English, but we need to be English Spanish. And we are picking up new languages because to survive in this culture is necessary for us to be bilingual. And we learned that. We learned that it was okay to teach the dear youth English, and that in fact, all of you here who held up hands about your parents may, as I, have had the experience of those parents knowing words and phrases from the old country. Maybe they weren't born overseas, but they had preserved some of the language. They were probably the children of the transitional generation, and they made it. They made the transition into English, and they brought us up as Lutherans within the new culture, speaking English, and maybe going to First English Lutheran Church or some other designation like that. So we survived the second crisis, and we found when we did that we became a part of the culture in a way that we had not been before. We saved the dear youth, and at the same time, we became a part now of the general culture rather than a ghetto, an enclave, a little group that nobody really knew much about because they all talked funny. So comes crisis number three. We've had one now of establishment, one of language. The third crisis, what we can call the cultural crisis. It's related to language, but it's just a little different. By cultural crisis, I mean the biographies, for example, of many of us. When the language ceases to be a kind of cradle that holds you, then the culture can become a kind of corral. Not a Bach corral I'm talking about now. I'm talking about a horse corral. It happens that Herb Chilstrom's family and my father's family come from about the same place, Minnesota. He grew up in Minnesota because his parents stayed there. My parents moved to California, moved out of Swede Grove, as it used to be called, later Grove City, and to Los Angeles. What did they do when they got there? They looked around for a Lutheran church, because there were a whole host of sociological and cultural ties that still made them feel most comfortable in the Lutheran church. It had nothing to do with the theology or the confessions or the liturgical tradition, none of that. What it had to do with was the fact that they found themselves looking for a home similar to the one they left behind. And it was the cultural accoutrements, if you want to call it that. Who did they band together with? I thought back of the church council in Alhambra, California, where the Lutheran church was on a side street right across from a strange building that was a pyramid shape, shingled from the top to the bottom with a cube-shaped building in front with round little portholes like the marks on a die. It was some kind of church. Never knew what it was. My parents said, oh, people go there, religious nuts. So we never even bothered to find out. The Grace Lutheran was across the street, and who were in Grace Lutheran Church? The council consisted of Peterson, Sorensen, Larson, Anderson, Rugen, German, let in by somebody or other, and Hans. They were also German background. Well, that kind of folks, they had found themselves. Their radar had picked up, and they had gotten together. And so they were held together because, presumably, as Lutherans, they had something in common, probably their faith and their way of worship, but also a lot of other things. I delighted some years ago in a little article that appeared in one of our Lutheran magazines called You Can Always Tell a Lutheran. And what this does is hold up some of these cultural quirks that have been maintained. For example, Lutherans generally have less money than Episcopalians, but more money than Baptists. That's not true in South Carolina, but it is true in the other places. Lutherans have more fun than Mormons. Lutherans make better coffee than almost anyone. In fact, at our recent convention, there was a presentation on the Augsburg Confession and the Lutheran heritage, and they had commercials. And they took the Sanka commercial, you know, about the guys all nervous and everything, and they showed two fellas standing there, one guy kept dozing off, and the fellow said, what kind of coffee are you drinking? And he said, oh, I drink this decaffeinated brand. And he said, ah, you don't need that. He said, what you need is some First Lutheran coffee. It's real coffee. And so then they drank First Lutheran coffee, of course, and they were really bright. And, there you go. And he said, the best thing about it doesn't have any effect on me at all. Okay, that is part of it, the good coffee. But let's pick some others. Lutherans wonder a lot about people named Olson or Schneider who belong to other churches. They also wonder about people named O'Brien and Gagliano who belong to Lutheran churches. South Carolina is a town not far from us called Peak, South Carolina. And in this area, that name just wouldn't fit the town at all. It's a pretty flat country around there. But a young man in Peak told me that until he was 18 years of age, he thought everybody in the world was either Lutheran or black. Again, it just says something about the cultural heritage of Lutherans and our ethnic traditions. Lutherans don't think the church should abandon the principle of the tithe. They don't think the church should insist on it either. Lutherans who have never been on the church council claim they don't know what goes on at council meetings. Lutherans who have been on the council claim they don't know either. Lutherans enjoy church suppers and will pay as much as a dollar for the privilege. Or one close to that, which I like, if I can find it here, about visiting speakers. Let's see. Well, here's one in the meantime. Lutherans generally are suspicious of pastors who have spotlights trained on their pulpits. Lutherans trust other Lutherans except in matters of judging what is best for the Lutheran church. Lutherans listen to sermons with great interest except when they are thinking about something else. Lutherans believe in miracles and sometimes expect them, especially during stewardship drives. Lutherans believe in offering an honorarium to a guest speaker. If he declines it, they believe in inviting him back again. Well, I can go on this way. There are many, many other such, but it was simply a way of saying that there are lots of things in the Lutheran Church that are related to the way we do things and have nothing really to do with emphasis on the gospel or on a rich liturgical tradition, but have to do with other things. And why did my parents seek out other people to help form a Lutheran church in Southern California? Well, of course, it was partly because they wanted to worship as they had worshiped before, and partly because they wanted some of that good Lutheran coffee, I suspect. They liked to be with people of the same name who came from Minnesota. And they would go to Long Beach every year, to Bixby Park, to the big Minnesota and Iowa picnics, where there were picnic tables there designated for the counties of every county in Iowa and Minnesota, so that you could go to that picnic table and find out who was there from the Midwest for the winter, and find out how your kinfolk were doing and friends, and by going from table to table, you could cover any number of counties you wanted to cover just that way. So that was culture transplanted from Minnesota to far coast. Well, that kind of cultural corral helped maintain the church for many years. And when Lutherans moved, they tried to find other Lutherans. But that is less and less true. Take the situation now in Florida. Many folks, many pastors, for example, live in, let's say, Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And they're looking at the role of their church, and every January when they have to submit their parish reports, they discover that 35 people have moved away, and 20 of those have moved to Florida. And so they record a net decline in membership. And finally one day they wake up and they say, why don't I move to Florida? Spread out my apron under that apple tree. All these people from the north coming down here, I might as well catch a few of them instead of recording their leaving up here. So they moved to Florida, and they discovered that when Lutherans moved to Florida, they like to take a little vacation from the church, and they don't immediately pick up with a Lutheran church. In fact, many of them will say, well, I've been a Lutheran so long, I'd try something else now. I'm shopping around. And they discover that many, many of those people who leave, move to another area, are no longer finding the cultural corral that strong, and they are jumping the fence and going into other groups. Well, that could be bad, but the good side of that is that we've discovered that as our cultural profile begins to move down, we are beginning to be enriched by people who otherwise would have felt totally not at home. The Lutheran Church in America, which I'm a member, has set goals, for example, for a more inclusive membership, actual numerical goals for each biennium, for each 2 years, working toward 1985. are consciously trying to increase the inclusiveness in terms of Spanish-speaking, Black, Orientals within our church fellowship. Not only because we think it's good for them, but also because we feel that without that inclusiveness, we are not really being the church as we ought to be. And so we seek, in many ways, to broaden that cultural mix. And I hope some of you had the experience of being in a church function where you have heard perhaps the music or the worship contribution which some of these other traditions now are bringing into our worship and Lutheran service. So, crisis number three, the crisis of sociological constraints, of cultural constraints, is being hurdled. We're getting over that. And we are discovering on the other side not less Lutherans, but more potential Lutherans and a wider and better variety within the church. So I come now to the fourth of these crises, the fourth teddy bear we've had to longingly give up, and that has to do with the family. Now, there's probably no more tension-filled issue among most of us than the question of what's ahead for the family. It stands, I think, probably even ahead of that of the church. Many questions about the future of the family, and we don't need to rehearse those statistics. I want to simply pick up the religious side. And that is that, as we pointed out a minute ago here, when we held up hands, those of you who are children of Lutherans are in a vast majority. Those of you who are parents of Lutherans, Lutheran adults, are in a very small minority. And that either means that lots of you have no children, or it means that what has happened is that the options open now, that the family traditions are not that strong, and that parental guidance into the Lutheran Church is not that strict, and that young people are finding their friends and their religious ties outside of the Lutheran Church. A study of generations, which was made about a decade ago now, tried to find out statistically just what was going on. And it made the somewhat startling discovery that over half of young people in that decade, over half of the people 18 to 24, when asked the question, who are your five closest friends and how many of them go to the Lutheran Church, discovered that 54% of the people, over half of the people who responded, said none of my five closest friends are Lutheran. Now that simply means that probably mate selection will occur in a situation where a choice will have to be made. Will both parties become Lutheran? Will both parties go to the other church? Or will they try to maintain some kind of separate tradition? Or join a third group as a compromise or as a new experience for both? Well, that means, of course, that we're losing some people because we are not able as families to sort of make sure that our children go following our own footsteps. But, again, what's the other side of that? Well, the other side of that is what Herb Kjellstrom discovered when he asked us to hold up hands at the first setting. All oriented that way here. The first session this morning, certainly the Latin word for setting, so it comes out the same way. How many of us had come into the Lutheran Church as adults and by adult baptism? And there were a smattering of people here who had come in that way. That element is going to increase. That is, if the other side of the fact that we have our children going to other denominations is that we are getting the children of other people who are choosing to be Lutheran, who are coming in not because of language or because of culture or because of family pressures, but because they want to be Lutheran, because they discovered the Lutheran Church somehow a vehicle for the God, the relationship to God, which they feel is truest to the Bible or to their own sensitivities to God and the way He works. Now, that doesn't mean that we're done with problems. Lutherans have always been a contentious group. I have here before me the Litchfield paper. Litchfield Independent Review from August of 1978. They have a nice column there called 93 Years Ago. They don't do it like 50 years ago and 60 years ago. They have two columns, one is 61 years ago and the other is 93 years ago. I just thought you might be interested in the fact that tension seems always with us. Kandiyohi County is having a church war. This is from 1885. The two congregations, respectively, of East and West Norway Lake, by vote, dismissed their pastor, who, however, refused to submit. New locks were put on the churches by the trustees, whereupon the reverend gentleman, accompanied by a few of his backers, broke open both churches and took possession of the same. Okay, that's Act 2. Act 3, the trustees of one of the churches pitched him out of the building. Warrants were sworn out for the pastor, but he skipped. The cause of the affair was a difficulty among the members of the congregation, one faction remaining loyal to the pastor. And then the editor onto the case. It is a pity that affairs of this kind so often occur among those who profess to emulate the meek and forgiving ways of Jesus Christ. It serves to bring into discredit the religion of these latter days. Now we have tensions not only within the family, but also within the church family, continuing below these 93 years. And yet, one must ask the question, are we whistling in the dark when we say, well, we survived all of these other crises, and we'll probably be able to get past the next one as well? It's very inspirational and upbeat to say we've made it so far, and every crisis has looked so difficult as we approached it, but on the other side, we've discovered a new opportunity. More people involved in support of the church when we went to the voluntary system. More people enriching the variety of the church when we got out of the cultural situation. More people choosing, having the opportunity to choose the Lutheran church rather than simply be catechized in it before they knew what was happening to them and brought up sort of automatically. All those are good things, but we ask ourselves, I guess there might still be some realists here who are saying, how do you feel when we remember that the baptized membership in the LCA, for example, has declined steadily for the last 11 years? Are we just whistling in the dark? We talk about hope in a culture where most people know their astrological sign. In fact, more people know their astrological sign and know what church they belong to. How many blows can the church take? How much is enough? How much neglect can it tolerate? When do we reach the point where no new cards can be pulled out of the castle without the whole thing coming crashing down? Well, of course, I have led you in a certain pattern of thinking today. I started with the established church and one by one took away teddy bear after teddy bear. State support, language, culture, finally family tradition. And it all sounds sort of like we're getting down to the very bottom of the pile. But really, we need to enlarge our picture, because the established church is never the standard way in which the church exists. That was, in fact, a kind of historical anomaly, something that does not often occur, but did occur for a number of centuries in Western Europe. But the true situation of the church, the way in which the church has always made its impact and grown, is precisely on the one-to-one relationship where it has been the individual who has been faced with a choice. In fact, those passages of Scripture which talk about leaving father and mother and family remind us that the earliest tradition of the church was that it had no family or culture or anything else on its side, but that individuals confronted with the possibility now offered by Jesus Christ and the kingdom of God were faced with a decision which might indeed alienate from parents and culture and all they held dear. So it's not an unusual situation for the church to be in. And in fact, it is perhaps closest to the point at which the church is the church and must rely not on the teddy bears' security blankets we've talked about, but on those everlasting promises that Wes Preeb led us to think about this morning in our morning devotion. So what's ahead for the church in the 80s? I would suspect really rough sledding. I would say that it's going to be a tough time for the church, but it's going to be a great time for Christianity. It'll be a great time for those of us who see in the challenges the opportunity to communicate a vital and a living tradition, conscious that the power of God's Spirit will give us the words we need to say when we are called upon to say them. And I want to give a little chance for conversation, but tomorrow we are going to deal with that question: do we have anything to say as a church in this culture, and how do we say it? It's sometimes called evangelism, but we're not going to be talking about the methods so much tomorrow. We're going to be talking about what we've got to say, who needs to hear it, and how we do it. But now maybe some reaction and some conversation about what I've tried to lay out this morning.
You alluded to it, but you suppose that Christians have another teddy bear called denominational teddy bears, which may be something that will in time be on the way out.
Do you see that as a possibility?
Well, probably not in our lifetime, but it certainly has been changing greatly our relationship, for example, with the Roman Catholic Church, our relationships with other denominations. It is certainly much freer and much more open and fraught with much fewer suspicions than used to be the case, I think.
There are those who say there are more similarities across denominations than sometimes within individual denominations.
Yes,
that is,
yes.
You could almost slice it a totally different way and move people in a different way.
My husband and I in the past year just moved to a new area in Washington and found that one of the biggest similarities, we visited other denominations and trying to locate a church family, that one of the biggest similarities in the different denominations was their distrust of other denominations. And then when I got right down to doctrine, not dogma, but doctrine, they were very similar.
You mean it was an institutional distrust then? It wasn't a doctrine?
No, it was a doctrinal distrust. They do not know what the others preach and teach,
but,
and suspect that it's very different than their own.
But when you get down to it, they're not. Somebody over here.
I was just going to say, too, if when you said that people joined churches because they wanted to be a Lutheran, I wonder, it's kind of picking up on what both of those people said, if it isn't, if they went to a place where people, they felt love of people and they liked the pastor. I hear that so much. I don't think even Lutherans, really much of the time, know how Lutherans are different than other denominations. And I wonder if it isn't just where they go, where they feel there's going to be a community of people that care for them. It doesn't have to be Methodist or Lutheran or whatever. And the other thing, I just want to make a comment that I heard on the radio a couple of days ago a report that projected that by 1994, one-fourth of the people in the United States will be speaking Spanish. And I thought, well, we better really get on the ball and have some Spanish-speaking pastors trained and so forth. But then when I hear you talking about our language as being a teddy bear, do we expect all the Spanish-speaking people to give up their Spanish and speak English?
Okay, those are two good questions.
As an interesting commentary on what you have said, which I find very interesting, I was baptized and received all my church schooling in Swedish, the confirmation preparation too. But of course I went to ordinary schools, and the moment we got out of the school, why, it was all English. And I've often thought, well, wouldn't I have received a lot more benefit if I had gotten my religious instruction during my youth in English, the language of the day? But since then, I have realized that I got out of it far more than I then realized. And I still use the Swedish language by choice for my devotion and for everything. None of our children speak really Swedish, and none of them have gone to any other denomination. My wife has learned some Swedish from me, though she didn't go to Swedish Sunday school. But it stays by me, the Swedish language.
Yeah, the richness.
And some of the finest things that I know in any language concerning our Christian faith are in Swedish.
I wondered why you left out the Finnish tradition when you were going through the Scandinavian countries.
Yeah, that was finished. You're grouping him with the Russians or Ukrainians?
No, the Mongolians.
All right, I know. There's a Finnish wanted to be kept separate and not mixed in
with all those other. Really? That's right. Yeah. There's a chance this afternoon
to get straightened
out
on.
Well, that's why I'm going to go get straightened out. But. I speak because I am Finnish tradition,
surely.
and I'm coming from that background with I too took all my instruction in. In the Finnish language. I read it and write it now, not as well as I used to. But when I went to church, when it was turned to English, I found myself trying to translate for myself. Mostly when I went to the Finnish service, I found it very difficult, to be translating this all the time.
Well, that's the other side of two languages. It can be enriching, and also sometimes it's, for a young person, it's difficult to pick up.
I'd be interested in your comment. Maybe you're going to cover this Wednesday, but one of the strange things I see now is the countercurrent of a lot of ecumenical dialogue, especially the bilateral dialogue with specific denominations, coming to understand each other better. On the other hand, rising denominationalism. The ecumenical congregations that we've tried around the country have not done particularly well. We tried one in a planned community outside of Minneapolis, and it just sputtered until finally we gave it a Lutheran identity, and suddenly it's taking off. One of the bishops from Pennsylvania tells me that even the old Union churches are breaking up. And they're separating themselves, and there's the identity of United Church and Lutheran. Why this seemingly contrary movement? Do you have any feeling on it?
I do hope to deal with that something
okay.
On Wednesday when I look ahead a little bit for Lutherans, because I want to talk about dialogues. I would say, though, that it's been picked up a neo-denominationalism, some people call it, a new denominational identity seems to be coming, and there may be factors ranging all the way from the fact that people are looking for certainties, and you seem to be able to get farther in certainty when you have a clear denominational position rather than saying, well, we've got to be tolerant of this, that, and the other thing, and it ends up for many people as being terribly mishy-mash. All the way from that kind of sort of psychological hope for a clear delineation of the faith to the financial side, which is that the churches are just not having the extra dollars to invest in ecumenical support and interracial, not interracial, but interdenominational work, and have instead had to pull back and sort of keep the what they consider the core crew operating. And that has tended to, that their ecumenical limbs seem to be the ones easiest to prune, and financially, yeah.
I'm one of those that raised their hand as not having any Lutheran parents and having gotten here because I married a Lutheran, but also we made a conscious choice of that. I grew up in a family which was very unconventional as a child. I lived with grandparents, and I had a Catholic grandfather who had married a Methodist person, who was my grandmother, and they went to the Methodist church until he was about 70 years old and ill and went back to his Catholicism. You know, that didn't happen when I was a youngster in a Catholic community, which was where we lived. And people kid me about being the first ecumenical because I went to both of those churches with my grandparents and also was part of the Baptist Youth Fellowship in our town. Long, you know. But I consciously chose Lutheranism.
Why did you do that? That would help us in terms of Mary's earlier question about the reason.
You know, partly because my husband's family are strong Lutherans, and it was something that we, you know, would have been difficult to pull away from that. But the other part of it is we have moved many times, and each time we could have made a choice to become Methodist or Baptist or one of those other traditions. But the liturgy was something that has held me as a Lutheran. That's something. The Catholic liturgy as a youngster and a teenager when I went with my grandfather, I didn't understand very well because it was in Latin and I didn't know Latin and a lot of it didn't make any sense. Methodists had very little liturgy. I came from a fairly formal Methodist church, so we had some, but very little. And it seemed like those two things, the liturgy being in English, in the churches that I went to anyway, that I could understand, and it gave me a focus for believing and thinking in church. And I remember as a youngster going to church, and if my mind was somewhere else, it stayed there. It never focused. You know, I could sit through a whole service and not get a thing out of it because I was somewhere else. I can't do that in the Lutheran church, because the liturgy pulls me back. And maybe it's because I don't know it that well. Some of the rest of my longtime Lutheran friends say it doesn't do that for them.
Okay, we got time for one more. Thank you for that personal biography. Yes.
I think it's really important, though, that you know, even taking away all our teddy bears and people who like to predict that perhaps it might be a demise of this denomination or that denomination. I think it's important to realize how crucial it is as human beings to have a certain kind of identity. And much of my identity, much more than I knew as a, you know, I'm 26 now, and I'm just starting to realize how much of my identity has been shaped by, say, the things I memorized in confirmation and the things that I learned in Sunday school. And it just seems like that identity is so important that I think it's worth preserving, and I don't think it will die. I really don't.
That's part of the denominational tenacity, probably. You know, the denominations can teach and maintain the core tradition that during times of unrest, people seem to come back to find support.